I'm Al Filreis, and this is Poem Talk at the Writer's House, where I have the pleasure of convening three friends in the world of contemporary poetry and poetics to collaborate on a close but not too close reading of a poem. We'll talk, maybe even disagree a bit, and perhaps open up the verse to a few new possibilities, and we hope gain for a poem that interests us some new readers and listeners. And I say listeners because Poem Talk poems are available in recordings made by the poets themselves as part of our Penn Sound archive, writing.upenn.edu/pennsound. Today I'm joined here in Philadelphia at the Kelly Writer's House, as usual, in our third floor Garrett studio, as usual, by Max McKenna, longtime regular on the Writer's House scene, and for the past 2 years, a member of the Writer's House staff. Now, actually for about 6 years, if you add it all up, Max, now famous across communities of poets and poetry students worldwide by virtue of his status as a teaching assistant for ModPo, a free open online course in which a mere 36,000 people enrolled. And by Tej Silverman, poet, teacher, translator, whose book of poems, Houses Are Fields, was published in 2009, whose translations of Italian poetry have been widely published, whose own book will soon appear in an Italian translation, Houses Are Fields, mm-hmm. in Italian, and who teaches here at Penn, I'm glad to say, recently a fabulously successful undergraduate creative writing course on verse translation. Did they do only verse translations or other kinds of translations?
Only poetry.
Fantastic. This is Poem Talk, and that's appropriate. And by John Timpain, poet, teacher, and for the last few years, since 2009, media editor and writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer. And for 12 years before that, he was the op-ed guy for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Frequent contributor to the Inquirer's Sunday Ideas section and dear friend of the Kelly Writer's House, one of our earliest local supporters and author of Yes Siree, Poetry for Dummies. Hello, John. Welcome back to the Writer's House.
How the heck are you doing, Al?
I'm fine. I'm happy whenever you show up here. And Max, your first time on Poem Talk.
It's great to be here.
And you're a frequent haunter of the third floor, but not Poem Talk so far. So glad you're doing it. And Tej, you too. First time on Poem Talk. Thank you.
Thank you.
So today, folks, we're gathered here to talk about William Butler Yeats' performance of his well-known poem, The Lake Isle of Innisfree. Penn Sound's Yeats page includes three recordings of the poet performing this poem, which apparently was a standard at his readings. We'll listen to the October 28, 1936 recording. Penn Sound also makes available Yeats's two-minute introductory explanation of the poem, which preceded his 1932 performance of the poem. So here now is William Butler Yeats performing The Lake Isle of Innisfree.
I will arise and go now and go to Innisfree, and a small cabin build there of clay and wattles made. 9 bean rows will I have there, a hive for the honey bee, and live alone in the bee-loud glade. And I shall have some peace there, for peace comes dropping slow, dropping from the vales of the morning to where the cricket sings. There midnight's all a glimmer, and noon a purple glow, and evening full of the linnet's wings. I will arise and go now, for always night and day I hear lake water lapping with low sounds by the shore, while I stand on the roadway or on the pavement's grey, I hear it in the deep harp's core.
John Timpain, if you were forced to say what this poem is saying, I mean content, story, I feel this is like such a violent thing to do to this poem, but for starters, what would you tell a high school sophomore who needed to know what the content of the poem was? It was about
how powerful memory is. Memory of place, where you might be in a city and you see something that reminds you of a boyhood haunt, which is overwhelmingly vivid in your memory, and that one memorial moment triggers it.
Tej, will you take a shot at this, or will you just ratify that?
No, I love that answer, but I might answer in a different vein and. and tell them to make sure not to ask themselves what the poem is about, because it seems to me so much a way in which sound trumps the meaning.
Right.
And we can parse it and take its meaning apart, but we are killing it in doing that. And we should kill it to do that, but then we should bring it back up to life by reading it over and over. I think that's what poetry has over prose. It has a sound that is a really unbreakable case around its meaning.
Max, your thought on this question of content?
Well, this poem really is about the way that sound can be tied to a place and a memory, I think, as we started to say. And he's talking about, as Tage mentioned, all the sounds here, the linnet's wings in the night, the bees humming in the glade.
What's a linnet?
It's a small bird, I think. I looked it up, actually. The Victorians kept them as pets. It was a popular Victorian pet at the time.
John, I'm going to skip a little bit, but I know we'll circle back to these same issues. Why does W.B. Yeats read the poem in such an overtly performative way? He's not just reading it as a lyric poet might read it. He's putting some extra stuff in it, to say the least. What is that extra stuff?
Well, I know that there's another recording in which he said something like, "When I read this, I'm not going to read it like prose." So he is committed to poetry as music. And I think he also is committed as a performer to make sure that the hearer has a good time. We talk about how people should read poetry all the time, and I think he has a simple commitment as a man of the stage, if nothing else.
So how would you describe Max or Tage, or both of you, how would you describe the voice? Loaded question.
Oh, yeah.
Tage, you first?
Silly.
It's silly. It's so. I want to hear more about this.
Well,
it's too much.
I will arise and go now and go. I mean, it's hard to take that seriously. It's wonderful, but as John said, it's a deeply performative and quite over the top. Those R's, he rolls those R's like a train breaking down. I mean, just,
by the way, that is not
stop.
Native. That is not native to Sligo. Not, yeah. That is a Willed trill.
Do we consider him native of Sligo? No.
He's more complicated than
it's
that.
It's more complicated.
Pedigree.
Time in Dublin.
That accent is all messed up. I mean, his diphthongs are all messed
we're
up.
We're the wrong folks. But, you know, we don't have an Irish person in this group right now, but what is wrong? Can anybody say what's not Sligo? I mean, this is about a Loch Gill, which is near Sligo, so this is going to be a Sligo accent. It's not doing it the right way, right?
I'm sorry, I don't know anyone from Sligo. I can't speak to that.
Well, his interior vowels are all wrong. Like, he says the OU in about two different ways in many of the
How
readings
does he say
this.
Be loud?
Well, the Be Loud glade. Yeah. But that's more, that's Saxon. That's not Irish. Mm-hmm. And the other, because it would be more like Be Load.
So what's he putting on? He's inventing a performative folk voice.
That's exactly what he's doing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I answered my own question. But Max, you have a thought on this, I'm sure.
Well, sure. I think part of what he's doing is creating this unspecific way of performing. I don't think that he's trying to imitate the Sligo accent necessarily, but rather he's creating this almost otherworldly Irish way of performing that harkens back to some long ago time.
So Tate, doesn't it somewhat undermine the legitimacy of the longing of the Londoner longing for home to then construct a home that's not real?
Oh, I don't think that this home was ever real. This is not for his mother's ancestral home in Sligo. This is for an imagined home in the spirit of Thoreau's Walden on an empty island in the middle of a lake where...
But it's not Thoreauvian in the sense that Thoreau, at least, not quite as elaborately as he said, but, you know, he actually did build a house.
Absolutely. It's pure fantasy. So the fantasy of the voice fits with it.
We even have the bean rose. Oh, my goodness, I just noticed. Doesn't Thoreau obsess about his beans?
I think so.
Yes.
Yeah, I didn't put that together.
Yeah, he's got nine bean rows. Nine bean rows will I have there. All right, I think we should do some close reading of some of the sound. And since you brought it up, Tej, you first, and then we'll go around the horn. Teach us about how, we can't do all of it, but teach us about how the sound works somewhere in there.
I'll start at the beginning, and you guys can just take over from there.
Okay, good.
I love the way it opens. And of course, just the, why don't we get the basics out of the way, that we're dealing with three quatrains, and it's more or less iambic hexameter, right? With at the end of every...
Fourth line does something different.
Exactly. What at the end of every stanza, we go into tetrameter.
Right. But and it really you really feel the missing beats.
You really do, don't
it's very disturbing
you think
to
you're, me. When you read it, you think you're missing something, that you've got to add something to it. And we should... Yeah, I'd love to talk about that. But when I say iambic, I barely mean it. It's like it's 50% iambic, and then there's so much variation in here. So I will arise and go now and go to Innisfree. Those long eyes have a sense of ascension, of arising, and I love the way they start upward in the poem, and then the short eyes take over in Innisfree, as if that short eye is escaping from the long eye by the end of the line. I will arise and go now and go to Innisfree. I'd love to talk too about the caesuras and the way that almost every line carries that caesura through and delays what's happening. Cause this seems to me so much a poem about delay.
That even too would that, form a bit of a paradox about the desire to go.
Exactly. That he really doesn't he really long for Innisfree. He longs to long for Innisfree.
When I was a young lad in the town of Sligo, I read Porro's essays and wanted to live in a hut on an island in Loch Gill called Innisfree, which means Heather Island. I wrote the poem in London when I was about 23. One day in the Strand, I heard a little tinkle of water and saw on a shop window a little jet of water balancing a ball on the top. It was an advertisement, I think, of cooling drinks, but it set me thinking of Sligo and Lake Water.
How could such a young man have such a longing for something long ago?
I think it's young men who have all the longing for the long ago. I think the young men have this sort of corner of longing,
you.
Don't they?
I was inviting you to bespeak that paradox, right? Or hypocrisy.
Yeah.
That in itself feels really immature to me. But anyway, Max, what were you saying?
Yeah, he's on the Strand and he hears this this sound of trickling water.
And what is it?
And it's some sort of kitschy.
It's an
advertisement.
It's a window advertisement.
A refreshing drink,
or a
he says.
Sidewalk advertisement for a summer drink, and they're running a little fountain. And I believe he says there's a little ball somehow bouncing on the top of this fountain.
Yeah.
And is it the sound of the this fountain we all love? Don't some of us who live in cities buy these little restoration hardware fountains so we can hear the trickling? Is that there's something very watery about people? So, Tej, you're smiling. What does the sound of water have to do with any of this?
Oh, the sound of water has to do with the sound of peace and fluidity, and the of course the lapping of the water on the shore in this poem is happening throughout the whole. All three verses are waves lapping on shore with this rhythmic, endless, you can count on it to return, but it always returns slightly differently. And I keep thinking in this poem of that moment with the wave when, if you're watching waves, you can watch them pause as if they're sort of thinking, do I want to come to shore? Should I just go back out to the ocean? And then they crash. And that's enacted in so many of the feet, I think, in most of these lines.
John, how do we deal with the... concept of time in that last stanza. I will arise and go now implies, something's happened and I need to get back now. But the rest of that stanza is about how there's always this urge that I cannot, it's always night and day and I'm always feeling this and it's in my core. Is that just a standard poetic paradox, a romantic paradox, or is there something more to say about it?
Well, I should say that on one level it is sort of standard because this is often called the last romantic poem. I mean, this is like the most pre-Raphaelite of the pre-Raphaelite Yeats, the Celtic Twilight Yeats. And so, yeah, in one sense there is a standard sort of trope of being in this long in city pent and you know, yearning for the country. I might add, though, that the poem, whether he knew it or not, pulls against itself and runs back against that throughout the whole thing, showing how, even if he goes back, he's not... I don't believe, reading the poem, that if he goes back, he's going to cure this. And if it's in the deep heart's core, he's telling us something. He's saying, this is deeper than going to a place. This is something that's woven into what a person is.
And what is
Well, he doesn't know. He just knows, I think, some part of him knows, probably the poet in him knows, that you can't solve that. You know, that the idea of nostalgia, of yearning for a home that you can't get to, means it's fairly permanent, fairly self-undermining, self-distancing.
Is he in exile? I mean, is that where the poetry comes from? From either being or faking, not being where you really want to be? Max, you're nodding.
Absolutely, and I think that's suggested by the geography of the Lake Isle, in that you're sort of in isolation, but in an interior. You're not in, it's not an island that's off the coast of something.
It's a giant loch, and in the loch there are a bunch of islands, and one of them is Innisfree. Is Innisfree really an island in the... Okay. And he did go there as a boy with his brother, I think. Sorry, I got...
Cousin, maybe.
With his cousin.
I think so.
Yeah.
So it's sort of part of the mainland, and yet sort of apart at the same time. Mm-hmm. Difficult to reach. It's there, you can see it, but not everybody can go there.
Ezra Pound took on, with tutelage, direct tutelage from Yeats in London, I guess, took on this performative voice. Is there anything we should make of that? You know, why is it significant at all that Pound sounds more or less the same? Max, what is your thought about this?
Well, he's cultivating... Well, Pound's poems are less, or at least in the early poems of the cantos, are less concerned with this sort of Celtic character that
to
Yeats
be sure,
is.
Yeah,
is
to be sure.
He's more indebted to the classics, to Homer. And yet, they're sort of creating the two of them by doing this, creating this sort of new oral tradition in a way of performing the poems. I mean, it goes back to what Yeats says about not wanting to read it like prose, wanting to read it like verse, and wanting to honor all that work he took to make it sort of song-like and musical.
So, John, this is by no means a poem talk about Ezra Pound, but why would Ezra Pound perform the first canto, which is Homeric, specifically, from the Odyssey? Why would he perform this Homeric thing in a derived Celtic voice borrowed from Yeats? Is he making a connection somehow? Speculate.
Well, my speculation, I guess, would be that Pound was resting on two sort of opposing pillars in most of his practice. One was to absolutely insist on the primacy of the ancients, and the other was to make it new. So what do you do with that? You know, you try to recruit, if you're going to use the language of conversational, if you're going to write nothing that can't be found in good prose, which
right.
Pound said,
right.
All right, where are you going to get the authority and the music that used to be with poetry? So I think with Pound, especially in his later readings, you have a very strange combination of this Vatic bardic voice,
and that's what this is.
Yeah, this is bardic. This is the poet as hieratic voice, married to modern content. You know, it's a strange, very strange marriage indeed.
Let's listen to the first two lines or so of Pound, just to put that into the record, of Pound reading Canto 1. She begins, "And then went down to the ship, set keel to breakers, forth on the godly sea."
"And then went down to the ship, set keel to breakers, forth on the godly sea. And we set up mast and sail on that swart ship, bore sheep aboard her, and our bodies also heavy with weeping."
Tej, what's your thought hearing Pound after hearing Yeats? Any?
It's the same thought. It's that silly
thought.
But no, that's unfair. I love the first canto, and I am thinking a little bit about the hexameter in the Lake Isle of Innisfree, and the fact that the Odyssey is written in hexameter originally, and this sense of, there is this quiet sense of the epic inside the lyric, inside Lake Isle of Innisfree's tiny lyric, the sense of the long journey that it takes to get there, the endlessness mm-hmm. of an Odysseus figure arriving, always arriving.
Mm. How interesting.
That Pound takes into his attempt to actually write an epic, his sort of conscious failed attempt to write the epic.
So the Lake Isle Innisfree has inside its small lyric an epic.
I think so.
Epic longing, an epic urge, and the performative quality of it stresses that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I just want to know why we should care about this poem. Mm-hmm. I do care about it, but I mean, ask what's at stake here? Why do we need to? Why does this need to be heard and learned? John, you first.
Well, I think it's a great thing to be able to read a poem aloud from memory.
And this is one you can memorize.
Oh, you really can. And as Tasia's put it so well, the rhythms and the sumptuous orchestrated music make it good to memorize. And so just on that mechanical level, it's good for you.
It's good for you. Max, why should we care about the Lake Isle of Innisfree?
I think there's a lot going on here politically, too, and I think that it sort of teaches us...
Oh, we didn't talk about that. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. Well, I wanted to do a sort of geopolitical reading of the water, of the lapping water.
Please, be our guest. Go.
Well, sure. I mean, it sort of suggests, in some ways, the Irish Channel or the divide between Ireland and England, and mm-hmm. in some ways, the sort of split character of Yeats himself. And then, of course, his own lack of a sense of home or place, and then this longing that he has to mm-hmm. then struggle with. And if he probably continued reading this well into old age, because it has that sort of that political quality, and he was trying to elevate Irish culture.
Max or anyone, if it was meant to be Irish in origin, the poem, either faux origin or real origin, rather than adhere to English poetic standards, does it achieve that effect if he's trying to create some kind of distance? Because I tend to pull back a little against that assumption and think of it as in line with a Wordsworthian romanticism, and that would be in the English tradition. But anyway, what do you think?
Well, it's probably good to mention that he wasn't really good at Irish. He never really learned it. He tried, and he certainly would have seen it a lot and heard it a lot. Heck, I even had a great aunt who spoke Irish. You know,
but he was part of the move to make it required in the schools, right?
Absolutely, which is more is the pity that he himself was not very good at it, and he was not a linguist. He was very bad at reading French when poets in London were playing with symbolism in the 1890s, he would go to some of their readings, and he had the worst French among them. So having said that, I think that what he does, his ear internalizes, and this might go a little way toward answering Tasia's question, it internalizes the vowel values in Irish poetry that is in Irish speech and the stress values that you'll find, because it is really... it's more stress-related in Irish than in English. And I wonder if there was anybody writing in England at the time of this publication, which is, what, 1889 or 1890 or something like that, who would have tried even to write something like this. I don't think there was.
Can we, before we move on from that question, can we answer it looking at the penultimate line of the poem, "While I stand on the roadway or on the pavement's gray," which is such a sneaky line. Mm. It's the first place in the poem where he admits that he's not just in Sligo across the lake and he'll take a boat over to Innisfree and he'll be there.
And as if roadway isn't enough, because roadway could be anywhere,
exactly,
but pavement,
roadway,
really.
It's pavement.
And gray is London, yeah.
So, but it's interesting the words he chooses, and that makes me think that ultimately this poem is more Irish geographically and orally than it is English. Roadway instead of road. So the roadway could be a path, and that way that rhymes with gray and has this assonance with pave. And it's only when we get to the pavements, and then And then it's really undone with the rhyme between gray and roadway. It's like he's apologizing for being in London at all. And really, everything urban in that one line, which is the only line in the whole poem that he gives the urban any space to, is softened into a sense of, you can almost hear the tar being blended into rubble or gravel and softened into a dusk.
Interesting.
Through the sound.
Absolutely. And even I Will Arise and Go Now is not a city movement. It's not a I've got to be at somewhere at 3:15
not at all,
kind
not
of
at
movement.
All.
Arise and Go is almost as if there's a floating quality to it. We could do this forever, so let's go around really quickly and say, please say something brief but final, something you just want to throw out there that we wouldn't otherwise have had a chance to say. So, Max, you have a final thought?
I just wanted to mention again that story that he tells in that 1932 recording about being on the street and encountering this kitschy advertisement. And I think that in some ways is such like a perfect little lesson in modernism and in high modernism. Like you encounter this sort of banal commercial urban thing, and yet it sort of undoes itself and transports you, almost propels you to this natural other world. Even
that's cool. I had a flash to the most famous Imagist poem of the Paris metro turning into petals on a bough.
Can I borrow that?
Yeah, go ahead.
And
you go next.
That same image in a different way, because I keep thinking about that image too. I love what you just said, but I keep thinking of it not in modernist terms, but simply in straight up metaphorical terms, with this weird little white ball floating on top of the fountain.
So weird.
Yeah.
So weird. But I think for me, that white ball is the poem's meaning, and the water are all the sounds that just keep buoying it. How do you say buoying? Buoying and buoying and buoying it, endlessly floating it and unable to tear themselves apart. They all do come together like water with this meaning at the top, but, you know, as I insisted at the start of this, intact and unwilling to be anything but a really weird white ball that you're not allowed to define in some way. Now I want to really go nice. On about all the sound in here that we haven't talked about. I know there's not time and you'll edit that out, but damn.
We won't edit anything that you've said, Tayshia.
Maybe damn.
So
maybe
good.
Damn.
Maybe damn. John Timpane, final word, quick.
This was the kind of music that he later became embarrassed about. And in fact, it was only about 12 years later that he starts his long progression toward a different kind of poetry. Everybody thinks it was Ezra Pound swooping in. Well, no. Look at the poems written about 1902, like Adam's Curse or The Folly of Being Comforted. He was throwing away the very sumptuous romantic vocabulary. He was trying to get back to a plainer way of speaking. He's a guy out of place looking to recruit a place for himself in the universe. And
that's part of the story of this poem, in fact.
Exactly right.
That's great. Well, we usually end Poem Talk with Gathering Paradise, which is a recommendation from our poem talkers about a book or a poem or a poet. But today I want to switch it up and ask you each to recommend an idea. An idea that you think is compelling that you want to put into the record. Could be a literary idea or another one. Something that you think we should be thinking about today. And so, Max, do you have an idea to share?
Yeah, I want to pitch a poetic idea somewhat inspired by Yeats, but also thinking about the internet and cell phones and technology. And surely after this poem, Yeats got into mysticism and the Spiritus Mundi and things like that. And I think he would do these automatic writing exercises, right, with his eventual wife, and he would just try to write down the things that she was communicating to him. And somebody who used to work here actually told me that we are telepathic. We just believe that we have to hold a cell phone to our faces in order to talk to somebody else. So I'm wondering if there's a way to do some sort of Yeatsian telepathic writing exercises. I think that'd be a fun, strange thing to try.
I'm so glad to hear a mystical interpretation of the internet. We need more of that. John Timpane, an idea you want to share?
I've been thinking a lot about authenticity, because you hear it talked about all the time. It inhabits the same place in many sentences that used to be inhabited by the word God. And I think the funny thing about authenticity is it's a crock. It's an absolute crock, because if it exists, we cannot know it. But it's probably worth trying to work toward.
Nice. Authenticity. Tej, follow that.
All right. My son just turned one, and he's about to start speaking. You can almost watch him getting ready to say his first word. And I just recently read that the first we speak one long sentence throughout our lives, and what we hear at the very beginning of our lives is similar to what we hear at the very end, which is, "I love you. You're not alone. Don't be afraid. Go to sleep." And I keep saying that every night to my son and thinking about how, as someone's dying, it's also the same thing that you say to them. And I've just been thinking about the ways in which we begin with the same language that we end, and watching this new creature enter into that sentence.
Oh, I think we should do these ideas thing at the end of Poem Talk every time. We had the mystical internet, we had authenticity, and we had the circle of life as one long sentence. I'm all in favor of it. Well, that's all the arising and going we have time for on Poem Talk today. Poem Talk at the Writer's House is a collaboration of the Center for Programs in Contemporary Writing and the Kelly Writer's House at the University of Pennsylvania and the Poetry Foundation, poetryfoundation.org. Thanks to my guests, John Timpane, Tej Silverman, and Max McKenna, and to Poem Talk's engineers, plural today, Chris Martin and Rebecca Caton, yay, and to our editor, as always, the very same, talented Steve McLaughlin. This is Al Filreis, and I hope you'll join us again soon for another Poem Talk.